Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Professor Armin Falk, who is Director of the Bonn Laboratory for Experimental Economics at IZA, the Institute for the Study of Labour at the University of Bonn. Armin and I met at the Centre for Economic Performance in London in October 2008, where Armin was speaking at a workshop on happiness research. He was discussing recent papers he'd done on social comparisons and how our individual perspectives of these social comparisons affect our well-being. He began by explaining how he uses experiments to conduct this research.
Yeah, I use experiments because I'm interested in causal inferences. That is basically the major advantage of running experiments in comparison to, say, using survey data, which is also very important and complements our findings. But it's at some point very important to establish causal effects. And the two papers I presented today are, in fact, related to the issue that you mentioned, which is how and whether people compare with others and how this is affecting their subjective well-being. And we measure subjective well-being in these two papers in two different ways. One is we measure heart rate variability, which is an indicator of stress. And the other indicator is activation in the so-called reward circuitry in the brain. There are two workers in this experiment, two subjects, if you like, and both of them are scanned in a brain scanner. Both are doing a job, a simple task, and if both of them do the task correctly, both of them get paid by the experimenter. And we basically study three conditions. One condition is both get the same wage. In another condition, one worker gets more, the other gets less, and the third condition is the other way around. So what we can study is, for a given own absolute income, how is the brain encoding the information that the co-worker who did the same job, who did not better or worse than I did, receives the same versus receiving more or receiving less. Now, from a, say, traditional economic perspective, we would expect that what matters is absolute income. And, of course, the more the better. And this is also what we find in the scanner study. What's more interesting, though, is relative income matters as well, and it matters dramatically. And we find in particular that reward activation is measured in terms of ventral striatum activity, so activity in the ventral striatum, which is an important part of the reward circuitry in human brains. So activation is strongest if we have more money than the other person, followed by if we have the same amount of money, and activation is weakest if I have less money than the other person. So this establishes, if you like, that social comparison matters, that the brain encodes these differences instantaneously, if you like, immediately. Social context really matters, and we can reject the hypothesis of, say, traditional economic model that it's only absolute income that matters.
How widely applicable do you think this is? I mean, you're testing students, presumably. You're putting them in these machines and asking them questions. How much does that tell us about what people are operating like in their real lives, as it were?
This is a good question. I mean, it is true we are studying a very stylized situation to start with, and the subject pool is typically students. But I mentioned in the beginning that we are complementing studies that use real people, if you like, people working in the workplace, using much larger data sets, long-run studies, and they also find strong correlations between unfair treatment at the workplace, so for example, a mismatch of what I think I should get with what I actually do get, and later, maybe years later, adverse effects on health, stress, cardiovascular diseases, and so on and so forth. The problem with these studies is a bit to identify causal effects, because it could go both ways. You're sick, and therefore you have lower wages, say, or you have lower unfair wages, and therefore you become sick. That's the advantage of our study, and I think in this sense, these two ways of getting at the problem are complements, and I think we need both type of studies in fact.
Now tell me about the second study, the one about unfairness, mm-hmm. Or attitudes to unfairness in the way people are paid at work.
Mm-hmm. The other paper is to some extent related. Again, we're interested in how you compare what you get to what you think you should get or what you would consider as fair. The setup is very simple. There's a principal, a boss, if you like, in a firm, and a worker, an agent. And the agent works on a tedious task and generates revenue and money. All the money he generates by working on this tedious task is going to the principal. And after some time is over, in the experiment it's something like 30 minutes, the principal receives all the money and can then decide on how to allocate it between himself, the principal, and the agent. Now, given that the agent did all the work and the principal did not work at all, most agents would consider a wage of at least 50% or a share of the total pie of at least 50% as appropriate. And in fact, most people want more, average being something like 66%, two-thirds of the pie. Now, the principals offer on average only about 40%. So we create some discrepancy between what principals are willing to share and what agents think they should get, what they think is appropriate. And we take this difference between, or this discrepancy between what you think you should get and what you actually do get, as a predictor for stress. And we measure stress in the experiment by measuring heart rate variability. And if heart rate variability is low, stress is high, and we find a very, very strong correlation between the amount of unfair pay, as measured by this discrepancy between actual and appropriate pay, and heart rate variability. And again, this is complementing field studies, but nicely showing a causal effect of unfair pay, perceptions of unfairness, and adverse effects on health via stress reactions.
I mean, it seems to be these experiments, you're really digging deep into the human nature, really, trying to understand physiological reactions to experiences in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. That's correct, and I think this is a trend in the social sciences and economics in particular, which comes under the head of neuroeconomics, which is basically trying to look at biomarkers affecting two things, biomarkers as dependent variables, but also treatment variables, if you like. For example, if you do hormone treatments and so on. To extend our knowledge about the nature and the principles, the structures of economic decision making. So, for example, in brain research, we have now already a better understanding, I think, of how we take, for example, intertemporal decisions or risky decisions. Instead of assuming one utility maximizer, for example, it is probably better to, in light of the newer evidence, to think of a dual self approach or multiple self approach. Which means that parts of the brains want immediate gratification. They want the money now, and they want sex now, and they want chocolate now, they want the nice things now. And then there's a controlling part inhibiting some of these prepotent impulses, which says, look, wait a minute, it's more long-term oriented and so on. And it's a kind of a rivalry between these two systems, which explains many of our decisions. And this is a totally new way of thinking about how decisions come into being, and this competition between several systems will also lead to different policy implications in the end. Or take a different example. It's a long discussion, it's a no-brainer that economic preferences are extremely important for decision making. For example, risk preferences are important for occupational choice, for how many stocks we hold, and as part of our wealth portfolio. It's important for what type of wages we get. Wages are higher if people are more willing to take risks, and so on and so forth. It's related to a lot of immigration, so it's related to a lot of economically relevant behaviors. But economists talk and know little about where preferences are coming from. And we're just starting to better understand the social demographic determinants of, say, risk preferences, but also other preferences. And it's only a natural extension to dig deeper and to ask, maybe there are even neural correlates, genetic dispositions, and so on. And what we try at this point is to extract both behavioral measures of social risk and time preferences and economic decision making and so on one side, and DNA on the other side, and then to relate genetic dispositions to economic behaviors to really better understand where preferences are coming from. This is again also relevant for policy, if you like. For example, think about social mobility. So one of the issues in many European countries is that kids, or the economic success of kids, is much determined by economic success of their parents. For example, in Germany, the likelihood that you have higher education depends extremely strong, more than in other countries, I think, in Western Europe, on income of your parents. So there's low social mobility. Now, if our preferences are based on genetics, and if genetics are passed from parents to kids, the government can't do much about it, right? So, but if this low social mobility is coming from the institutional environment, for example, the context and the social environment and so on, there's more scope for policy intervention. And I think, of course, even if we find that genes are important, it's not determining all of our behaviors. That is absolutely clear. But in its own right, it's interesting to study whether there are some of these dispositions.
And final question, going back to the research we were talking about on attitudes to fairness at work. I mean, what policy implications are we in a position to draw policy implications from that about, for, you know, for companies thinking about how they reward their staff, and also for governments making decisions about equality legislation?
I do think we can draw policy implications from this. One central message, my central message, if you like, to policymakers and firms and managers and so on, is don't think that fairness issues are just distributional issues. They are efficiency issues. If you treat people in an unfair way, this is bad for your revenues, this is bad for your performance, because people who are not motivated will not work. And since contract enforcement is a big problem, because work is not enforceable, you rely on voluntary cooperation of workers, you better treat them in a nice way, in a fair way. And if you can, because, say, the economy is in bad conditions or the firm is in bad conditions, then communicate why you can't. So it is very important to take people seriously, to give them social approval, and to treat them with respect, ultimately. And I think that will pay off tremendously.
Armin Falk, many thanks.
Thanks.